Hey, what's going on? It's Jace Talk Plus, Blake Murphy, and Julia Kreutz with you. If you are looking for Masai Ujiri's end-of-season press conference, there's not a Raptors show today, but over on Sportsnet 590, The Fan, we are carrying that. You can also find it at sportsnet.ca. And as usual, that will be up on sportsnet.ca or the Raptors YouTube after the fact. This is Jays Talk Plus. If you're listening on podcasts or Sportsnet Plus or Sportsnet 360, thank you. And we got a great game to talk about. The Blue Jays win 6-3 against the Atlanta Braves. The bats come alive. Kevin Gausman looks good again. Julia, how are we feeling?
Blake, they couldn't have given us this type of game for our first show of the season. Come on.
Not only that, but the Yankees won, so we still don't get to do a first-place show. The Jays are still hanging half a game back in the AL East. They just won't let me cover a first-place team.
We'll reverse the curse eventually, Blake. This is a long season, and if things keep going the way that they were yesterday, may not take that long for us to do a first place show here.
Yeah, long season and things are rolling right now. The Jays off to a 10-8 start. We touched on this a little yesterday, but when we did our opening day setup of the season, we had kind of said this opening stretch, 11-9 was a good target. Now, one of those games was rained out, but they're going to finish it either 10-9 or 11-8. So, given what the schedules look like on paper, that's the form.
Yeah.
We've had some complaints along the way about the style in which they're winning, not that wins are wins. There's no column on the standings page for how pretty it was. There is a column, if you click the second page, for how many home runs you fit, which until last night, the Blue Jays were in dead last. So let's start there. This is the story of the game, really. The Jays entered play dead last in home runs, tied with the Kansas City Royals with 9. And then before the Jays even got to the plate, Kansas City had hit a home run. So the Jays were sitting there in dead last. They'd been out homered 21-9. There were teams with three times. Like, the Angels had 30 home runs. Obviously, the Dodgers and Yankees have a million home runs. Right. But it was looking pretty bleak. And for the first time all season last night, the Blue Jays hit multiple home runs in a game. And for the first time all season, they homered with runners in scoring position.
Right on.
All of that kind of happened at once. Alan Rodon and Anthony Santander both getting it going. Man, let's start with the Santander one because sure. That is such a beautiful lefty swing. I know he's a switch hitter, but that is, like, when he gets into one, that is just such easy power. And it's like, man, how does this not happen 35 more times this year?
Well, he doesn't get many middle cutters, right? That is why it hasn't happened all that often, Blake. But, you know, that is very much a matter of good approach and sort of understanding where a pitcher is at. Schrellenbach was pretty honest post-game in saying that he didn't really feel like he had some of his breaking balls and some of the off-speed stuff. It just wasn't working for him. And when that is the case, a pitcher is going to make adjustments in-game and he's going to go to certain pitches more often. And so this is the fifth inning. They have already seen him a couple times. They knew what to look for. And Santander certainly knew what to look for there. Mm. And from that point on, the power is there. The strength is there. The ability to drive that ball. We know that that is why Santander is here. That's why he signed the deal that he did with the Blue Jays. So kind of what's expected of him when you see a pitch that is just that good, that perfect to hit, right?
Yeah, 94. And, you know, this is a Joe Siddle-ism, but like when a cut fastball doesn't cut enough, it's just a bad fastball.
That's it.
Is what it is. And we can look at some of the like pitch design metrics and stuff like that. And they were like, hey, Spencer Schwellenbach, when it came to the slider on the four seamer last night, still looked like Spencer Schwellenbach, but the secondary stuff and especially the cutter just didn't have it for whatever reason. It sounds from talking to guys over the years that the cutter is a tough feel pitch because it is kind of in between two pitches with your four-seamer and your slider. But yeah, Schwellenbach didn't really have it. And interesting enough, he has not been gotten to very much in a year and change of his career, and the Jays have done it twice now.
Yeah, very interesting. And also because he has pitched a little bit differently this year than the look that the Blue Jays got last season. But with guys like that who throw as many pitches as he does, maybe it is a little bit about, you know, just eliminating certain quadrants, certain parts of the strike zone, focusing on something else and understanding that he is trying to pound the zone every single time. He doesn't walk a ton of batters, and that is a big part of what's made him good. And so Santander is looking for something in the zone right there, plain and simple. And, you know, obviously it was a mistake pitch, first pitch of the at-bat, and that is what good hitters do. I will say, like, this felt like the first time this season, and this may be unfair, but it did feel like it was the first time this season the Blue Jays legitimately punished opposing pitchers' mistakes. Mm-hmm. We had not seen that very often with that level of authority and confidence in what they were doing. There were a lot of middle pitches early on that they just didn't swing at or fouled away, and those are the pitches that you're looking for to do damage. So not just with Santander, it was good to see the lineup top to bottom really come in and punish those mistakes by a very, very good pitcher in Schwarzenbach.
It's a fascinating thing to look at, you know, holistically for the league as well, because it's something that comes up with like Aaron Judge, the people who, you know, don't think he's the MVP, or it's like, oh, well, pitchers throw it down the middle to him. And then you pull the numbers and it's like, well, pitchers miss in the middle. Like, it happens. Pitching is a very difficult thing. And like we talked about yesterday, when Easton Lucas lost his touch, it's not just balls, it's where your strikes are in the zone. And that happens. And, you know, statistically, Aaron Judge doesn't get many more mistakes than anyone else. The Yankees don't. But Aaron Judge is like the greatest hitter in baseball at punishing those. And yeah, he's really good around the edges. And Juan Soto can take, you know, a pitch that's an eyelash off the plate, and he knows it's an eyelash off the plate and stuff like that. But if you are going to be a 30, a 35 home run guy, if you're going to be, you know, Vlad or what Santander needs to be, if you're going to be Judge, you have to absolutely be on top of when pitchers make mistakes. You also have to get like a tiny bit lucky too. Like Santander, his single was also a cutter that was just like right down the center. Yep. He didn't get a lot of it,
yep,
but he got enough of it to drop in there. So yeah, this is part of it. And I think when David Popkins comes in and he's talking a lot about like, I like damage. Uh-huh. And the last couple of years, it's been all about, okay, swing decisions. The Jays don't chase a lot. The Jays have a really high contact profile as a team, and like individually up and down the lineup, they don't swing and miss a lot as a group. But you got to be able to punish these mistakes. And whether that's, you know, hey, we're gonna wait on Schwellenbach's, you know, we're going to sit heat on him because we can adjust to the other stuff, and you can't, you know, if we sit spin, we're not going to be able to adjust to the fastball or whatever. Or in Santander's case, I'm just looking for a mistake middle in.
I've seen this before. I've seen this mistake before, and I kind of got it to go, got a little lucky. I'm not going to get lucky this time. I'm going to drive this ball out of the park.
Exactly. And it's fascinating. I love, we're pretty spoiled with our Jays broadcast crews in general.
Yes.
But Joe Siddle was in there last night, and he was like he was calling the game for Drake Baldwin behind the plate. He's like, okay, this is what they did. And like, there was a really fascinating thing going on where the Braves don't use pitch comm unless a runner's on second base. Mm-hmm. They still use old school signals. And like, they don't really disguise them that much. So Joe was in there like as if he's Drake Baldwin saying, okay, this is coming, this is coming. And you can see though, like, yes, Santander was looking for mistakes, but Vlad, for example, Vlad had a walk in this one. I think he had two walks in this one. And one was like the pitches weren't that competitive. And then there was another one where the count went full and he like the third ball, like he knew it was a slider. Mm-hmm. Like he knew that slider was coming. It was probably going to be low. And it was, anyway, it was just fascinating that A, Joe was just sitting there calling, this is what's coming, this is what's coming. But B, that Vlad was like in the same headspace of like, okay, this is Schwellenbach sequence. This is what happened last time. The Jays just like seemed, it was just a very, and we haven't even touched on Alan Roden yet, who had a bunch of smart at-bats, but it was just a very smart game plan, it seemed, with Schwellenbach.
It's curious, right? Because there are these very, very, very good pitchers, and then there are certain teams who just seem to have their number. It brings me back, or takes me back, to Kevin Gausman with the Twins. For whatever reason, Kevin Gausman never does well against the Twins. They always seem to know what's coming, and I don't, like, the last thing I want is to get into tipping pitches and whatnot. That is not what I'm suggesting here. But there are certain teams with, you know, these superstar pitchers, or in Schwellenbach's case, a superstar in the making, they just have their number. They just know what's coming. And that was pretty much on display there, just how well the Blue Jays game planned for Schwellenbach. And you mentioned the swing decisions there, Blake, and this is something that has significantly changed about the Blue Jays' approach and game plan from last year to this year. Where last year, everything sort of seemed predicated on staying in the zone and swinging at pitches in the zone, Blue Jays are not that worried about that this year. It's more about finding the pitch that you can drive. It doesn't really matter where that pitch is. And I can only imagine how freeing that must be for a guy like Bo Bichette, who is, you know, a free swinger. And he can get to those pitches that are low or high, or Ernie Clement, who, you know, has belted home runs on pitches that are chin high and has gone back to the below the zone to golf a slider for a double. So you see the different approach, and you're now starting to see the results and just how impactful that has been to certain hitters in that lineup. I don't know if that's something that you've picked up on or you've noticed as well. What are the differences, I guess, that you are seeing from the approach based or last season compared to this one?
Yeah, it's you know, that damage talking point should be a big one. And you're right, they have swung a little more freely. They're fifth actually in chase rate this year, which is a big change for them. But they're first in contact rate, so it's very clearly, I don't know, they're not doing, even after a two home run game yesterday, they're obviously not doing enough damage overall. 11 home runs isn't going to cut it, and home runs aren't everything, but you know, a lot of singles, you got to stack a lot of singles to, you know, to get where you want to go as an offense. And it's such a contrast to the Braves, who are like the three-run homer. Like, they're built to get three-run homers. But yeah, they're managing to thread a needle right now of swinging a little more freely.
Yep.
And hey, if you want something and it's off the plate, you can go out there and get it. Just make sure it's something you can go out there and get. Obviously, that's an Ernie and Bo thing. And this is where, like, anytime I look at, like, the team level, like, oh, chase or contact rate or whatever, like, okay, team's made up of 9 very different parts. Ernie and Bo are extremely different than Vlad and Roden in terms of how many pitches they're willing to take. And hey, can I, you know, in Vlad's case, can I let 2 good strikes go by because I'm so confident if I get the third one that I'm looking for, you know, and again, he hasn't jumped on one yet, but he will. But yeah, as a team, it seems, you know, the damage still isn't quite there, but the ability to expand the zone, which to me says, hey, they've got the green light a little bit to swing at something they like. You know, not necessarily bad chase.
Yep.
The fact that they've maintained the highest contact rate in baseball says they're doing a good job with that, at least so far, or like personnel-wise, the right guys have the green light to do it.
You did mention there that there's a wide variety of hitters on this lineup, and we talk about Anthony Santander's home run in a way. We're going to talk about Alan Roden's home run in a different light.
Yeah.
I'm wondering what you saw from that at bat specifically there.
Yeah, I mean, that one was like the home run itself. Schwellenbach just hung a curveball. Like, we keep talking about Schwellenbach making mistakes in a game in a way that he doesn't really make them all that often. I liked Roden just like being ready to jump on top of that. I will say, by the way, a great thread on Twitter this morning from Chris Black at Down to Black going into some of Roden's early season returns. But we saw a lot of different stuff from Roden over the course of this game. You know, the home runs just, hey, let's show some nice power. That's a curveball that just like stayed middle low
just
kind of hung up there. And yeah, nice catch, bud, by the way. I know some people can't see, but the ball like went right to a group of dudes in right field and no one made a play on it. By the way, at the game I was at Monday, there was a foul ball pop fly right near my section.
Yep.
And an adult with a glove dropped it.
No.
Adult brought a glove to a game and bobbled the foul pop fly.
Was it you?
It wasn't me. I'm not bringing a glove to the game.
The glove.
No. Okay. You saw, I'm not, because I would have to bring a glove to the media room too, which would be
that,
super.
No.
You
would not.
No.
That would not go well.
No, I'd rather break a finger and embarrass myself that way than come in here the next day with my hand wrapped up than.
Yeah, no, yeah, fair. I respect. Me too, I would say.
sorry, so I got us way off the point. Look, Roden just punishing a mistake there.
Yeah.
I was just as impressed with what happened in earlier in the game with him, where he gets the double to lead off the third and then makes a pair of great base running plays. Tags up on an iffy bow liner to right field and then scores on the contact play's not even on, I don't think, but Vlad hits the chopper, so he takes off the home and is able to slide in there. And then this is like not to do Space Jam when Michael Jordan strikes out. And it's like, oh man, when you strike out, you make it look good. He had an 8-pitch strikeout where some good takes, fighting off some stuff on the inner third of the plate, which is, you know, an area I think he's gonna get attacked with heat a little bit more to see where it's coming. But yeah, just 3 really good sets of plays with the homer, the double, and the good base running, and then a quality strikeout that got the pitch count up and really showed, you know, a sense of the zone and an ability to fight.
Well, that's kind of what he's shown pretty much since he got to the minors, right? It's the ability to control the strike zone and to fight off tough pitches, to make contact, to give other guys in that lineup different looks, because Schwellenbach had to, you know, sort of try a lot of different things to retire Roden in that at bat. So that's what he's here for. That is why he made the team out of camp. That's why he was singled out early on in spring training. And it's just got to feel good to get one out. You know, again, Schwellenbach speaking post game and saying, yeah, I'm trying to stay in the zone. And so that curveball was always meant to be a strike, but it was just too good of a strike.
Yeah.
And you know, a hitter that is seeing the ball as well as Roden has, and who has the contact ability that he does, he's not going to miss that too often. So, but yeah, I would imagine it has to feel good to get that first one out of the way. And now you can sort of just focus on what's made you good.
Yeah. And I mean, the early, and look, this is early or small sample data, but it backs up what we saw from him at the higher levels of the minors, where we can see the numbers on this stuff. Is like, he's a good non-fastball hitter. So for him to go up there and have the confidence as a rookie who hasn't hit a home run yet, to, like, to your point, you asked Schwellenbach about it, and he was trying to get an 0-0 curveball over for a strike, but to be up there and be like, okay, even if I see that nasty curveball first pitch, I can jump on, like, mm-hmm. I have the light to jump on a first pitch breaking ball. Even if it, you know, and like when you're up there, I'd imagine he doesn't know, is this going to drop out of the zone? Like, is this a strike? Because it was right on the fringe. You know, it probably caught a little more plate than Schwellenbach wanted,
just
but
a
like,
little bit, yeah.
But you know, that's there's a reason Schwellenbach thought he could get it over for a strike. He probably thought he would buckle him and fool him, not expecting a breaking ball in the zone. So I like the confidence level, and the like, just the attack mentality with the non-fastball stuff that he's seen so far. Again, Chris Black has a good thread on this at Down to Black on Twitter. Do think he's going to start getting challenged with hard stuff, and hard stuff in a little more frequently, just to, you know, just to see.
Yeah.
Can he handle it? Because right now the damage he's doing is on not that stuff. So we'll see if he can handle it.
That will be an interesting one, Blake, because we know that the contact ability is there, and we know that right now he seems to be seeing the ball very, very well, but this is the major leagues, and making adjustments is such a big part of a rookie's sort of journey. You know, and he wants to stick. He doesn't want to go back down to Buffalo. It doesn't look like he is right now with the way that he's playing, especially when you add in the base running. That was a very, very impressive sequence.
Yeah.
By Roden. Yeah, it was just like a veteran's play in understanding his speed, understanding the contact, understanding where the ball is going to land, and how much time you have and what you have to do. It's just all of the little things, Blake. And there will be more little things, and there will be big things. And this is just sort of the nature of the business. But so far, so good. And he's got a good head on his shoulders. It's a cliche because it's true. And we see that. You talk ball with Roden. He understands it. He's a data guy. He's a numbers guy.
He's a physicist.
He's a physicist, you know, smarter than you and me. And so that is the type of rookie that you want on your team. It's now up to him to sort of digest that and figure out what he can do to adjust back.
Yeah, and if you're going to bet on a guy being able to figure out the adjustments, you know, like there are some guys who are going to come up and be good, and then the pitchers adjust, and then they're going to need to go back down to figure it out. You know, Addison Barger last year struggled initially after killing it at AAA, came up, got out of his swing mechanics a little bit, focused in spring training on kind of getting back to that, and, you know, had a really good spring. He was up yesterday, by the way. John Schneider told him to hit a home run, but he didn't do it.
Yeah.
So I don't know. Is he punished? Is he going back down? Coach tells you to hit a homer. You go up there, the Monty Burns, Daryl Strawberry, hey, hit a homer.
Okay, skip.
And he doesn't manage to do it. Alan Roden, by the way, friend of the show, came on last year with us when he was with the Bisons. Okay, are you good on Roden if we pivot to the pitching side?
Yeah, let's do it.
Another pretty good at bat from a hitter who's pretty locked in right now. Austin Riley got 11 pitches from Kevin Gausman and took a splitter that was like just below the zone. Like
good pitch.
Gausman could not have placed it better in terms of, like, that's probably a strike, but Riley just couldn't let it go. The 11th pitch of the at-bat, and he takes it deep. But otherwise, for Kevin Gausman, you got to be really happy with that performance. Where is, like, you were in the Braves locker room after. Riley is just, like, so locked in right now. Did he speak post-game?
Yeah, I did ask him about that at-bat specifically. Like, what are you seeing? Because obviously there aren't many secrets with Kevin Gausman, but at the same time, when the splitter is good, and it was good yesterday, or at least better than what we saw recently, there's very little you can do to lay off of it or to make contact with it. So basically, I just asked, just take me through that at bat. And Riley was very honest in saying, listen, I was just fighting. He was pitching very, very well. He was making his pitches. I know that with a guy like that, you need to stay, you know, center field. That needs to be sort of your mentality, because if you try to do too much, if you try to swing too soon, that is when you get fooled and when you get those awkward swings. And that's what he did. And that's what Matt Olson did a few innings later. It's just really understanding that if you're going to do any type of damage against Gausman, you need to just fight and stay ready for whatever may come. I still think that was a very good pitch, Blake, yeah. And it takes a special hitter to hit that out of the ballpark. At the same time, that at bat, that early on in the game, I was watching and thinking, uh-oh, here we go again. This is going to be another tough one, and it wasn't. Gausman very much locked in after that. The splitter had a ton of late movement, which, again, we haven't necessarily seen all that much recently. It was closer, I'd say, right, to the Kevin Gausman we've come to know and love.
Yeah, and more and interesting in the sense that we're coming off a game where he had zero strikeouts, and we're coming off a game where he had 10 strikeouts, but it was almost entirely with the fastball. We're like, hey, where's the swing and miss on the splitter? And it wasn't, you know, a crazy amount of swing and miss in general yesterday for Gausman, but he was back to mixing both of those pitches in and getting some swing and miss. He went to the slider a couple times in interesting spots. Like, usually the slider's just a show me, and I wonder if, like, because of a couple of those long at-bats early, he's like, okay, these guys are, like, fighting off fastball splitter. I gotta mix in a slider here and there. The one to Olson was just, I think he didn't get a fastball inside enough to where he was trying to groove it. But yeah, it was good. It's the other thing he did really well in this one. I think there were 21 foul balls off of him, which he continues to be right near the league lead in batters fouling balls off. And now that could be a negative when there's two strikes, you know, get the pitch count up and stuff like that. But it really does speak to, like, it's probably the best stat to back up what Austin Riley is saying, that when you're in there in Gausman, against Gausman, you got to fight. And, like, it's so hard to square him up when he's on like that, that, yeah, maybe you can chip a few away, but, you know, it's going to take an Austin Riley heater level guy to get good contact against Gausman when he's pitching like that. The other thing Gausman mentioned after the game, and this is especially notable in a game where he had zero walks, and like we said, the home run pitch to Riley was like could not have been closer on the bottom of the zone to being a strike. So the command was really good. Gausman talked post game about mixing up his velocities a little bit, taking a little off the fastball at times to when he needed to hit his spot, is the way he phrased it. What do you make of that? Like, when obviously we tend to pull, hey, here was the average radar reading for that game, but this is not the first time we've heard Gausman talk about mixing his fastball velocity a little bit.
I think we saw that more significantly with Bowden Francis a little bit, when, you know, he kind of bounced between the bullpen and starting a little bit. And when he became a full-time starter, we saw him take a lot off of the fastball in order to hit his spots. And that's what comes to mind when Gausman says something like that. I don't know how much value actually exists in going from 92 to 95 or 96 and then going back to 92. Probably does give hitters a little bit of a different look, but I do think this is more about, you know, making sure that he's hitting his spots there, Blake, and staying in the zone when he wants to be in the zone. I don't know. Where do you fall, I guess, on this whole mixing velos with the fastball thing?
Yeah, so big picture, you know, the data is pretty clear over Gausman's Blue Jays career that the harder he's throwing the fastball, the better his results are. And that's true of the results on the fastball and how the splitter plays off of it. I will absolutely, understand, I need to hit this spot, or it's the 11th pitch of an at-bat, I need to take a little something off of this, or it's the first pitch of an at-bat, I can take a little something off of this. I certainly understand situation specific, where you would want to toy with your velocity a little bit, add a little something, take a little something off. Big picture, though, we've got a pretty good amount of evidence that when Kevin Gausman's fastball is a little harder, Kevin Gausman's fastball plays a little better, yeah. and the splitter plays a little better off of that. So I think it's one of those things where it's good to have that option there. I don't know how often I'd go into a game plan or go into a game being like, hey, I want to mix my fastballs a lot. I want to throw 93 a good amount of time, because generally speaking, with the exception of that 10 strikeout start where he actually didn't have a ton of velocity on the fastball, ironically, with the exception of that start for his Blue Jays career, the harder Kevin Gausman's throwing the ball, usually the better that fastball is.
We saw him hit 96, dare I say 97 yesterday. Mm-hmm. No? So clearly the velocity is there, and whoops, well, that was something that fell. Sorry, guys. But yeah, it was interesting to sort of see and then watch him speak post game about, you know, the intentionality of it. Do you believe that, you know, within it a bat, again, going back to the micro level, is there any added advantage to doing that just as a way to, you know, make hitters guess on something different other than just fastball splitter?
Yeah, I think a little bit. I would believe probably there's a little bit more utility in, or it's like, it's easier to actually like do it and see it when it's, hey, I'm gonna take just a tiny bit off. Gausman's term was like, just like ease up on the pedal just a little bit to hit a spot.
Yeah.
Like, hey, if I'm going all out to try to get 97 and blow this by this guy, my accuracy is not as pinpoint
for
as
sure.
It is if I'm in the 94 range. I would understand that a little bit more. Like, and there are guys who do it. I used the Justin Steele comp for Easton Lucas on Blue Jay Central the other day, a lefty who doesn't throw that hard, but he kind of throws like three or four different versions of his fastball. The difference is like, that's not a lot of velocity mix so much as it is movement mix. And, you know, the big, a big trend right now for guys who don't throw super hard is, well, I'm going to throw a four seamer and a cutter and a sinker. Chris Bassett does that, right? Hey, my fastball is not, we're going to see it today. I don't throw 95, but I've got three different movement profiles on this fastball. So even if you pick up that it's fastball out of my hand, that can cut. It could ride back in on you as a righty. You know, Gausman's fastball has some higher ride. And I do think this is like what you're talking about, what Gausman's talking about, is part of why he brought back his two-seamer, his sinker last year.
Yeah.
So he had a different option specifically against righties. But I tend to think that the movement profile is going to be like having fastballs that move differently
sure.
is probably going to be a little more impactful than like, hey, I'm going to take a tick or two off this fastball. But it's so hard to like capture this like numbers wise, because you don't know the pitcher's intention, right? Is it like, oh, did Gausman throw a seventh inning fastball at 92 because he's gassing out, or because he needed to hit his spot, or because this is the third time Julia was seeing him in the box? Like it's so such a fascinating thing, which is why it's like it's so helpful to have pitchers on the team like Gausman and Bassett who talk about their craft so openly.
Yeah,
because it's helpful, because you know I've never thrown 94, so I don't know.
Speaking of the sinker, has he thrown the sinker at all this year? He hasn't, right?
He is not one that's been logged mm-hmm. as one. I thought there was one yesterday that had some like whip back to the arm side against a righty, but Statcast didn't classify it as one at least. So we'll see. I'd have to ask him about that. But he did, even if he has, like he's thrown it way less than he did last year.
Yeah, so. For sure. And, you know, I don't think he's missing it all that much right now.
No, certainly not going to argue with the results. Great graphic on the Blue Jays broadcast last night that Gausman's now made 96 starts as a Blue Jay, and his ERA is right up there with guys like Dave Steeb and Roy Halladay as a Blue Jay. Now, those guys pitched in eras where the offensive environment was much higher. So, you know, when we compare to league average, it's not quite, you know, it would be blasphemous to say anyone's in the Halladay Steeb category anyway, yeah. But on ERA alone, Gausman's right there. It's been a lot of fun. Let's take a break. When we come back, let's talk about tonight's pitching match, this afternoon's pitching matchup,
right on.
Rather. The return of Spencer Strider, probably earlier than most people expected, given that he last pitched 12 months and 2 weeks ago,
mm-hmm.
yet had to undergo a second UCL procedure. Travis Sochik of The Score wrote about that, went deep, talked to Spencer Strider about it. He'll join us as Jays Talk Plus continues with Blake Murphy and Julia Kreutz.
Big opinions and in-depth conversations covering the Leafs, Jays, Raptors, and the NFL. The J.D. Bunkus Podcast. Subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. Blake Murphy and Julia Quartz with you. The Blue Jays and Braves will wrap up a three set. It's a 1:07 start today, not the usual 3 o'clock work from dome day. And in this 1 o'clock start, we'll see Chris Bassitt, who owns a sub-1 ERA so far this year. And we will see, for the first time since April 5th, 2024, Spencer Strider, Quadzilla, on the mound for the Braves. He had a 1.32 ERA on his rehab stint. When we last saw him, he was the number one strikeout artist among starting pitchers in all of baseball. Over 2022 and 2023, he had ERAs of 2.67 and 3.86, and he struck out over 37% of the batters he faced. Not only is that first among all starters, it puts him right up there with some of the best closers in baseball who can obviously just let on the gas for one inning at a time. How is Spencer Strider back so soon? What are we expecting from it? Travis Sochik of The Score, author of The MVP Machine and Big Data Baseball, joins us now. He wrote about it recently. Travis, how we doing, buddy?
I'm doing well. How are you?
Excellent. Very excited to see the return of Spencer Strider. How fired up are you for this one, especially given you went deep on his second UCL procedure and got a lot of good insight from him recently at The Score?
Yeah, I'm excited, like the rest of the baseball world, to see Strider back on the mound. When we last saw a full healthy season, he was, you know, arguably the best starting pitcher in the game. So, but also, I hope that his return can be a lengthy and successful one, just because of the procedure he had done and the history of second elbow surgeries to date has not been very good. Like Tommy John, the first time a pitcher has one, it is something of a miracle procedure where most pitchers return near their previous level of performance. But the second instance of such a surgery, which is happening more and more because of how many pitchers have had Tommy John to begin with, the results are not nearly as good. The MLB injury study that came out in December the return to previous level of performance in a second Tommy John was 59%. Jeffrey Dugas, the surgeon I spoke with for the piece, his research found that only 42% of second Tommy John recipients pitched 10 or more games in the major leagues. And given that 36% of pitchers have had one Tommy John surgery, this is not good. And there's been this defeatist mindset of injury and velocity and stress on the major league arm for good reason. But that's a long-winded way of getting to what Strider had done. He had Tommy John first time at Clemson University where he pitched. And when he went in, when he had elbow pain last spring, and he was some radiologist and surgeons thought he might need a second one. Keith Meister, who did his surgery, wasn't so sure. Looking at the MRI, it's not as good as imaging science is. It's not foolproof. It's not 100%. And when he went into Strider's elbow last April, he found that it was not as bad as some had anticipated. And he was a candidate for the internal brace, which Meister did perform. And we can get into the mechanics of if you'd like, but it's a relatively new procedure, but it's much different than Tommy John. It allows for a quicker return to play. It's not drilling the same tunnels through the bone. It's not working with it's not working with a tendon graft. So the hope is, while not every pitcher is a candidate for internal brace, it's another tool in the surgeon's toolbox. It is not the same procedure. And the hope is, you know, it will allow more pitchers a return to their previous level of performance. So that's a really long answer, but I'm hoping it's a breakthrough, because even Strider's not defeatist. He thinks there's going to be breakthroughs in surgery, sports science, and that, you know, it won't always be as dire as it seems for pitchers who need to go to the operating room for a second time.
Travis, you did mention not necessarily for everyone. That was one of the quotes in your piece that sort of drew my attention. Tommy John fits all. Internal brace fits some. We have a few success stories out already. There's Ryan Woo with the Mariners, Brock Purdy with the quarterback for the San Francisco 49ers. But what are, I guess, some of the novel challenges of such a new procedure like this?
So first of all, as a player, you have to be open to this. It's because it is relatively new. When Strider had his surgery, there had been only 41 pitchers above the Division I college level to have had it done. And it was a lot of those had not returned to play. It was so new. So one challenge is just buying in. The other is It's only for some because of it has to be a specific type of injury. And I learned more about the elbow than I anticipated reporting on this. But the ligament tear for an internal brace has to be near the bone, ideally, because ligament tissue, tendon tissue on its own doesn't really have a blood supply. It doesn't heal. So it needs, the surgeon has to go in, do some micro drilling in the bone. That creates bleeding and essentially scar tissue, an internal mortar of sort, where the ligament can reattach. And the beauty of the internal brace is that if you can just reattach the native existing ligament, and then you add in this super strong tape, for lack of a better term, to support it, that's the internal brace, and you drill it into the bone with these very 3.5 millimeter anchors, that is much preferable than adding a tendon graft, sewing a tendon graft into the existing torn ligament and drilling holes through the bones with which to thread it. So this is a much less invasive procedure, and ideally lets the existing ligament heal. And that's what Strider had done. He didn't have to have a tendon graft put in. They just reattached the existing ligament, put in the tape part of the internal brace, and put in the micro anchors, and he's back. And he was throwing bullpens, I think, in 9 or 10 months after surgery. And that's another positive for this advancement is, since the internal brace was the first major league pitcher, I think, was Seth Maness to have it. And since he returned with it in 2017, the average return to play is 11.3 months. And in that same time span, Tommy John is 18.8 months. So it's a quicker return to play. It requires less time to heal. So there's just a bunch of positives. And you're not drilling in. Another issue with the second Tommy John is you're having to drill into the same tunnels to promote healing, and you're attaching a tendon graft on top of a tendon graft, and it's just a weaker, it would just be like a construction project where you're drilling into the same part of drywall or board. That's, the more times you do that, the more prone to failure, the weaker the whole mechanism, the bulkier the joint becomes. There's a lot of points of failure for a second Tommy John, but Strider has avoided that, and hopefully he'll have a long second chapter, and it'll be, you know, just like Purdy, just like Wu, it'll be another evidence point showing that there is another way, there has been an advancement.
Yeah, and it's particularly interesting. I mean, it's interesting for the Blue Jays today because they're going against Spencer Strider, but I believe Alek Manoah and Brandon Barriera both had internal braces as part of their, I think Manoah just had internal brace and Barriera had the kind of combo there. So tracking how some of these guys return, not only in terms of what percentage get back after a second Tommy John or what the timeline is, but the effectiveness as well. Travis, obviously this is not the focus of your article, but you are a baseball fan. You are a pretty stat savvy analyst. What do you like? I guess, where do we put the, given what other returns have been either from internal brace or Tommy John, given how young Spencer Strider is, like, are we fully expecting like Spencer Strider to be back to Spencer Strider at some point, you know, maybe not today, but this year?
It's an interesting question. He looked pretty good on his rehab.
Yeah.
I think his velocity was down a bit, but I mean, his strikeout rate and the stuff was just playing really well. So just in talking with him this spring, he felt like he was in a really good place. And this was even before he began his rehab assignment. So I think, and you look what, it's a different sport, but you look at what Purdy did with the 49ers, and there's some reasons for optimism and belief that players can return to their peak level sooner than in the past. And to be clear, there are all these hybrid surgeries. Like Strider, as I understand, had just the ideal internal brace procedure. No tendon graft was required. They just put his existing ligament, which wasn't damaged that badly, back in place, added the internal brace to keep it in place while it healed. But there's all these other hybrid solutions, like Shane McClanahan with the Rays. He had a second Tommy John, but an internal brace added in that procedure. There's this new procedure called TJ3, where it's a repair of the existing ligament, a Tommy John, and an internal brace. So there's all these hybrid solutions using this new technology, the micro anchors and the tape that were really developed by this company in Naples, Florida, to, I think it was initially with ankle injuries and other things, but there's all these hybrid experimentations going on, which offer, because there's a spectrum of ligament injuries. So the internal brace is being experimented with to address a number of them. So I think just that's also encouraging, knowing that there's so many smart people working on different ways to address this this spectrum of injury that's plagued so many pitchers.
Yeah, I don't know. Spencer Strider looked like Spencer Strider in his rehab assignment. I'll tell you that much.
Tell you what, when your elbow's recovering, you could still do leg day, which it, of course, looks like Spencer Strider was doing plenty of.
Yeah.
And, his lower half is it's just the engine, you know? Yeah. And the other thing is his injury was not the result of any mechanical flaw or adding. Some people speculated that it's because he added a curveball in his return. Or added a curveball last spring before he got hurt, but it's really because when they did his first Tommy John, and that when they drill into the bone, it creates that bleeding, that scar tissue that heals, that adheres to the ligament, that had grown like a bone fragment that had chipped off and embedded itself in his ligament. So it wasn't even anything he'd done wrong mechanically or new pitch-wise. It was just a result of the initial injury, and that's another reason he wanted to avoid a second Tommy John, is, you know, the first one created this extra scarring that created a problem. So, it's another reason for optimism, because he avoided that. And hopefully, like we've seen his rehab, he can be that, elite ace again.
So we are getting better at figuring out how to reconstruct UCLs. Pivoting to a different topic you wrote about today, actually, at The Score, Travis, how do we reconstruct the Pittsburgh Pirates ownership group and front office? You had a great piece at The Score going into this is 20 years of Bob Nutting being the primary owner there. The on-field results are very bad, and now we have things like people wearing paper bags on their heads, people yell and sell the team at them. I know that's a team that you used to cover pretty intimately. Where are you at on where the Pirates are right now, man?
Yeah, I was a beat writer there 13 to 16. So I was there to witness sort of their peak of the last 30 years when they went to those three straight playoff appearances. But even then, there was a lot of animosity between fans and ownership, just with the lack of spending. And that's only continued since. It was especially pointed this offseason because the club essentially won the lottery and landing Paul Skeens with the number one pick, and there's just so little urgency and investment from ownership into the supporting cast this offseason. So fans were already upset, and then there are these very public PR fiascos with the Bucko bricks, where fans had these personalized bricks folks had bought, and the Pirates removed them in renovation and didn't tell anyone, and then a local TV affiliate finds that they've been sent to this recycling facility, and there's just images of a heap of rubble and all these mementos and messages to loved ones and wow, even deceased family members. So there's just been these PR hits. They replaced the Clemente wall in right field at PNC Park and had the signage commemorating Clemente, the great pirate and humanitarian. And they replaced that this offseason with an ad for a spiked lemonade. And that made people very upset, as you can understand.
Yeah.
So there's been these on-the-field issues that have just continued to simmer, these PR hits, and you just have these chants of sell the team. And even when Paul Skeens was introduced at Pat McAfee's event at the Penguins Arena in Pittsburgh last week, as soon as Skeens comes on stage, it's sell the team chants breakout. So there's just this real animosity that's built up to, I think, is, and speaking to a friend who's a lifelong Pirates fan, he said this is as low as fan morale has ever been. And it's not good for Pirates fans. This should be a time of excitement. You have Skeens, you have the top pitching prospect in baseball, arguably, and Bubba Chandler on the doorstep. But the conversation, the excitement isn't there. The conversation's about other things. And we see this, we see lack of ownership commitment in small markets. We know the financial playing field is, in terms of local revenues, is not equal in baseball, but it's just a shame to have this. It's the only major North American sport where there's this constant negativity in small markets because of lack of payroll and perceived commitment. And in Pittsburgh, it's especially extreme. And we're seeing it spill out. It's becoming almost a national. It's not just a regional story. We're seeing all these videos, all these PR fiascos. So it's a shame for Pirates fans who haven't seen their team win a playoff series since the 79 World Series. I don't think that's good for baseball. I don't think, it's of course not good for the Pirates.
No, it's ludicrous. And like the fact that you could have Paul Skeens, Jared Jones, and Bubba Chandler in the same rotation at some point this year and not be, well, I guess you'd be excited about that part of it, but not be excited in general is tough. So hopefully things round out there. Travis, that was a great piece, by the way. Awesome, awesome stuff on Spencer Strider and all the reporting with the Keith Meister around the internal brace procedure. I really appreciate you taking the time out this morning. Keep up the great work.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you.
Travis Sochick of The Score, also author of The MVP Machine and Big Data Baseball. MVP Machine, awesome, awesome book.
That was super educational. I really enjoyed that.
Yeah, it was good. It's I could do without some of the specifics in the article about like drilling into the bone and weaving the tendon through
and
stuff like that.
I love that stuff. I want to know everything that's going on in there.
Yeah, it is very, very fascinating.
Yeah.
And it's just cool. Strider was so open in speaking with him, speaking with him about how excited are you? You're going to head down to the ballpark after this one. You've been covering the Braves side of this series.
Yes.
You get to, of all, like, look, I know that in your role at MLB.com, you get to cover the visiting team sometimes. That's cool. I'd imagine, like, I mean, I'll just ask you, short of Shohei when he was here, if you got to do that one, like Spencer Strider's return covering the Braves, this has got to be up there as far as road team assignments can go.
Yeah, I'm not actually covering the game today because I'm here, can't be there for pregame and things of the sort, but anytime you get to witness something like that for a pitcher of this caliber, still going to be in the locker room in the clubhouse post game, so I will get to talk to him. And based on these quotes and everything that we know about Spencer Strider, he is such a thoughtful guy, just very clear how much he cares, how evidence-based he is, how data-driven he is, and that's what's made him good, too. That is why he has missed so many bats, is because it's not just the talent, it's also the mind for the game, which is always, it's always exciting when you get to talk to players who are open and who, dive into things a little bit more, especially when they are up there with the best in the game. So this is definitely a day that is going to be an iconic one for the Braves season. And I know that, Atlanta sees this as an opportunity to maybe right the ship a little bit and build some momentum. They have yet to win two games in a row this season, which is pretty crazy.
Yeah.
And you kind of look for those momentum shifts where you can. The offense is going. I was going to mention, we said yesterday that the Blue Jays were being out homered and just how ridiculous the margins were. It's actually gotten worse since yesterday because the Braves hit three homers yesterday. Yeah. Blue Jays hit just two. So, you can see that there is definitely room or reason for optimism there. And Strider's a big part of that. We don't actually know what he's going to look like.
We don't. It's also fascinating. So, obviously, a cerebral guy like this also throwing 96 and having a wicked slider is unfair. And then he's got a changeup that he throws against lefties as well. And maybe most fascinating to me is when we last saw him in 2024 and he only had those two brief appearances, but all the talk in spring was Spencer Strider's got a curveball now. Mm-hmm. Spencer Strider's got a curveball now. All the pitch design guys were like, this is sick. Like, he's going to have a fourth weapon now. Everyone was so excited to see it. And then we really didn't get to see it because of this. So I'm very curious if he'll mix that back in, if he'll just stay kind of fastball slider to get his feet under him. But either way, going to be some nasty stuff. It's, again, I said it earlier, over a 37% strikeout rate in 2022-2023 when he was one of the best starters in all of baseball. By the way, Chris Bassitt on the other side of this one, he comes in with a 0.98 ERA and a 29% strikeout rate that would be the highest of his career despite his velocity being down a little bit in the early on. Now he's had to pitch in some pretty cold and unfortunate, so I'm not looking too much into that one. Here's an interesting one. He's faced a bunch of these Braves guys before. In 2022, when he was with the Mets and Brian De La Cruz was with the Marlins, De La Cruz went 6-for-10 with a homer and a walk off of him. They faced each other four times in 6 weeks. Very odd. Four different starts for Chris Bassitt. Anyway, you know what to expect from Bassitt. Eight different pitches. He'll mix and match. Maybe introduce a ninth. They'll be all over the place. That's a 107 game on Sportsnet. Television with Danjo and Hazel, Jamie Madison and Mike Petriello coming up for you on Blue Jay Central. Ben, Chris, and Sho have the radio call for you on Sportsnet 590 and the Sportsnet Radio Network. Thanks to Travis for joining us, to Ahmed, Austin, and Jennifer behind the glass. We'll be back tomorrow at 11 to break it all down.